We spend a lot of our time with dogs, and yet most of us rarely stop to wonder at the uniqueness of our mutual relationships and the extraordinary abilities dogs have to adapt to our lives, expectations, and ways of living. Joining us now on Please Explain to Clear Up Some of the Mysteries of This Curious Bond are Dr. John Cervasi, a veterinarian and co-editor of Decoding Your Dog from the American College of Veterinary Behaviorists, and Steve Dale, who writes a twice-weekly syndicated newspaper column, is a contributing editor at USA Weekend, and the host of two nationally syndicated radio shows, Steve Dale's Pet World and The Pet Minute, and Steve Dale's Pet Dale's Pet World twice there, but how many shows do you have?
Too many, perhaps. I don't know. Two national radio shows, one local radio show on WGN in Chicago.
That's the third show. Okay. Well, we invite our listeners to join the conversation. You can call us at 212-433-9692 or write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or join us on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. John, although this may seem like an obvious question, I still want to start off by asking, just what is a dog?
What is a dog? You know, it's funny, when I was studying for my boards, we went through looking at old world monkeys and new world monkeys, and by the time we got done, we just looked at each other and said, what's a monkey? And so I think sometimes the definitions get kind of out of control and we lose the basics. But a dog, you know, a dog is a result of diversion from the gray wolf. And we think that happened as many as like 100,000 years ago.
They don't share a common ancestor?
No, the dog is a direct descendant from the wolf, and then genetically just kind of diverted from it. The wolf is Canis lupus, and the dog is Canis lupus familiaris, so it's a subspecies. And, you know, the incredible variability that dogs have in their DNA has resulted in, you know, all of the various breeds that we have today, everything from, you know, a 2-pound Chihuahua to a 200-pound Mastiff. So it's that variability that I think results in us keeping them as pets, because there's so many things that we get from dogs, and then hopefully we give back.
Well, Steve, as John mentioned, they can go from a 2-pound Chihuahua to a 200-pound Mastiff, and yet when they meet in the park, they always seem to know that the other one is a dog.
They do. So that's one thing, and that's part of this book. Part of what we'd wanted to do in this book was dispel myths, and one of those
the book
myths,
being Decoding Your Dog.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, and one of those myths of many is that it has been said that we need to be dominant over our dogs. We need to be in charge of dogs or they will dominate us. And there's this pack setting in the household. And if you're not the leader of the pack, the dogs will be. Well, one of many problems with that theory is, as you point out, dogs know a lot. Dogs know a lot. And they know two things for sure. They know we're not dogs, and they know who other dogs are. What's also interesting is the way other dogs greet one another, and how we've, and sometimes, set dogs up for failure, potentially. So we crop the ears, and that means the ears are straight up in the air. Well, when dogs greet one another and the dogs are up in the air, that's a sign, oh, I'm alert about that other dog. I'm maybe even worried about the other dog. I might be even aggressive about the other dog. But the dog has no choice because those ears are cropped. And there are many examples of this as we've changed breeds, and as we've done things to dogs, like cropping ears.
Now, they also often greet each other by sniffing in areas that humans would be arrested for sniffing in.
at least in most cultures.
What's that all about?
Well, I mean, it's you know, it's the canine handshake. You know, it's how they greet one another, and you know, there's so much information that dogs get from each other in that manner. There's glands everywhere, particularly you know, under the tail and around the genital area. So there's just myriads of smells and odors that they get and find out where they're from, where they've been, where they're going, who they've been with. It'd be a great skill that we would have, or maybe we wouldn't want that skill. I don't know. They learn a lot from each other in a very short period of time.
Well, you mentioned earlier that they all descend from gray wolves. Aren't there a number of theories about when they became a unique species? I've read dates that range from 100,000 years to 15 or 18,000 years. Why such a discrepancy?
I don't really have an exact answer, but I know science is not an exact science either sometimes. And, you know, the evidence seems to be derived from just DNA evidence, from, you know, fossil evidence and such. But right now the number that I'm aware of is around 100,000 years ago is when that split occurred. Now, dogs have been domesticated for a much shorter period of time than that. Most people think somewhere around 15,000 years ago is when the first domestication occurred.
Well, what about the way that dogs became dogs in terms of relations with humans? Did humans or proto-humans actively domesticate them, or did they domesticate themselves by attaching themselves to humans as they were wandering and hunting?
Well, The thinking is,
I mean, nobody knows for sure because maybe only Larry King was around back then, but the thinking seems to be that dogs, as human settlements threw out trash and other garbage outside their settlement, and these bold wolves, or actually wolf-like ancestors, really, came and scavenged. And some individuals began to go inside these human settlements. And it was advantageous to people because people had a war. I mean, there were big, dangerous animals back then, like saber-toothed things and giant animals that could crush people. So having a warning system, even if the dogs only warned to warn one another, or of course they weren't dogs, they were like wolf ancestors, but if they only warned to warn one another, that was beneficial to people. And the assumption is people figured that out. And the wolf-like ancestors figured out very quickly, well, these meals were a whole lot easier to get than working ourselves, as the human ancestors, which were Cro-Magnon men, threw out trash. Interestingly enough, experts tell me this, and this is not my area of expertise, but Neanderthals were not the big brutes that we kind of made them out to be in the movies. They were similar to Cro-Magnon men. There were some differences in culture, and one of those differences is the dog-like ancestors that we have today began to hunt, began to do things with people that we call Cro-Magnon men. They survived. They turned into who we are today. The Neanderthals, they didn't have these dog-like ancestors. They died out. So I suggest if it wasn't for dogs, we wouldn't be here. And what we do know is that we kind of evolved with dogs.
Well, I'm assuming that the less aggressive dogs are the ones who wound up meeting other less aggressive dogs, and they were the ones who stayed with the humans while the other ones decided to remain with their regular packs, the wolves.
Yeah, that's about what happened. That's true.
Now, Steve, you also deal with cat behavior in your work. Was the process of domesticating cats similar to what happened with dogs? Hasn't a recent book claimed that cats have never been truly domesticated, that they have remained, in essence, wild animals?
I don't know how John feels about that. I personally don't agree. Here's what we know. The cats domesticated themselves a little differently. And what I just said is one of the differences. We took some part way back when in the domestication of these dog-like ancestors I'm talking about. And far more recently, as John suggested, we began to breed dogs to specifically do things. So some types of dogs helped to get rid of vermin, the terrier-type dogs. Other dogs protected large communities. Other dogs brought meat to market, like Rottweilers were originally intended to do that, as one example. With cats, they as would figure they're cats, and even back then they said, you know, this is our decision. It's a good thing for us. We're going to get these vermin, and this is an easy way to get them. And for people, it was beneficial. So the process was a little different. I would say, though, cats are absolutely, today, domestic animals. Cats need us. In their own way, as much as dogs need us. The only difference, and it's significant, is that some cats can survive on their own outdoors.
Now, so John, when people started breeding the dogs, they bred them for certain qualities like fetching or herding.
Right. What I understand is that the actual formal profession of dog training I think, began after the war, the First World War, and there were, you know, people who were involved with managing and training dogs for the war effort, and when they came home, they kind of took it up as a profession, and then it kind of grew from there. And, you know, the profession, I think, at that time was more targeted towards dogs as working dogs. You know, you need a job to do, and dogs seem to fit the bill, and that's where it began. Well, of course, today, you know, training is primarily designed towards creating a more social animal within the confines of your home, but then also there's a lot of competition involved with obedience. There's a lot of shows, and it's become a sport more than anything at this point.
And well, one thing we do in decoding your dog is we talk about, and this is really important, about how to choose the right trainer. I mean, it seems so simple, so easy, but choosing the right trainer is really important. And if you happen to get a dog as a puppy, well, then you're at this impressionable age. First of all, go to a training class, even at a young age for a dog. That's the right thing to do. And then choosing a trainer that is motivating, that is encouraging, that uses positive reinforcement, that's what it's all about. Not all trainers are like that.
Now, John, we mentioned that dogs all recognize other dogs. They also can interbreed, whether they're, in theory, a 2-pound dog could interbreed with a 200-pound dog.
Well, in theory, that's correct. In practicality,
well, that's only because there were other issues there. But,
that's right.
But
yes,
as,
there are.
But
which
if you,
I don't think we want to go into during this show.
But so, no matter how different the breeds are, in the end, they have something in common, which is that they can all produce other dogs.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, the variability in the DNA gives us the phenotype, which is the phenotype is the outward expression of the genetic makeup of the animal. But the basic genotype, the genes that make a dog are all the same. And so, yeah, theoretically, you put the genetic material from any male dog and any female dog together, you're going to get offspring that look like a dog.
We are taking calls during this segment, and Anthony from Ramsey, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a dog that's a shepherd mix, and he was adopted as a puppy from a shelter. Whenever the dog hears a siren, a fire siren, ambulance siren, he goes into this howl, and it's like a ritual, and it's a series of howls. And he won't stop until he completely finishes, which could take up to a minute. Can you explain why he does this?
Steve, do you want to take that, or would you like me to do that?
It doesn't matter. You know, what's funny is our dogs have become a tourist attraction, I believe, if a fire engine goes by. And this is interesting here because this is how dogs can learn from one another. We have a dog, our larger dog named Ethel, who is doing exactly what you described. She doesn't do it indoors. She does it outside. But if a fire engine – we've even had a fire engine once. I'm thinking, oh, my God. They actually slowed down the watcher, and I'm thinking, you guys have a fire to go to. As she howls and howls, where our other smaller dog never did that. And soon she began to do it because our larger dog does it. I don't – you know, John can chime in here. There are lots of theories about it. One is that the noise hurts their ears, and by howling that – makes them feel a little better. It's kind of like the baby on an airplane sort of that begins to cry. I don't know that anyone really, really knows. There's even been a suggestion that they think that the fire engine is talking to them and they howl back, which I think is rubbish. John?
Oh, I mean, I guess what I would, the analogy I would use is that, you know, I sing in choir because nobody wants to hear me sing solo. And so I think dogs are just joining in on the sound and becoming a part of the choir.
They're singing along.
Yeah, so I don't think it's anything abnormal. Is it irritating at times? I imagine it is.
Because
dogs
will often howl while people are singing, as though they were just joining in.
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, you know, I don't know in terms of what to do about it. Either, one, sit back and enjoy it, get the popcorn out, or, two, the idea would be to, you know, train a competing, more desirable behavior. And that could be anything from, you know, just doing some simple training for rewards, or some dogs really are into, you know, for example, fetching balls, playing with a ball, or some play activity that the dog really likes. And just, you know, practice it and then make sure that you get it started at the time, just as the dog starts reacting to the fire engine.
Now,
so
not
just treating competing behavior.
Not all dogs like to bring back the thing that the ball. You throw a ball to one dog, he'll come back immediately, drop it in front of you, and say, "Throw it again." In effect, another dog will take that ball and do everything possible to deny you the ball. I guess that's all part of the genetic makeup of the breed.
Yeah, and it's also about training. You know, some dogs have a much higher drive to retrieve and return. That's part of their genetic makeup. But it's also about early training. You know, a good trainer can teach a lot of behaviors that amaze us. And, you know, anything from just basic games like we're describing to more serious activities, you know, dogs who can sniff out cancer, dogs who can sniff out diabetes, helping up. We all know about, you know, dogs who work with the blind. So this goes back to what we talked about, the incredible variability that dogs have that allow them to engage in all of these different varied activities with us.
And I want to get back to the dogs with the sniffing out cancer and other things a little later. But I thought I'd put Judith on the line. She's from Westfield, New Jersey. Hi, Judith.
Hello, Leonard. Can you hear me?
Yes, Judith.
Okay, I'll tell you, I have gotten such an education over the years listening to your program. It's really quite amazing. Anyway, we had a dog, half cocker, half terrier mix, really sweet, 15 pounds. And I began noticing that this dog is really psychic. You know, I say to my mother, "Well, I guess I'll take her out for a walk," you know, and she'd get all excited. So then I said to my mother, "Okay, dogs can learn a few words. Let's say it in German, okay?" Because, you know, I wasn't ready to go out right then. I was talking about a half hour hence. Well, that still didn't work. She knew what was going on. And then I thought, well, maybe she's really that intuitive. So one time my mother wasn't there, and I just pictured a leash in my mind, you know, like a cartoon picture of a leash. She came running in and jumping up and down. You know, I'd picture dog biscuits, something. She'd come and jump up and down, you know. And another thing I noticed, when I'd be praying, she would want to come really close to wherever I was praying, and she would put her head down and put her paws over her eyes. It was just an amazing thing. She wanted to be right there next to me when I was praying. And I think dogs are just amazingly intuitive.
So do you think that dogs have ESP?
Oh, well, I don't know if I would say ESP, but I would say, you know, some say that dogs are a little piece of God on earth, and I would agree with that, and goes along with the praying ritual that that you described. But, you know, dogs are amazing in terms of what they can pick up. They are much more tuned to body language and communication, nonverbal communication, much more than we are. You know, we really focus on vision. I mean, that's our biggest sense, but in dogs, it's body posture, it's hearing, it's smell. Obviously, their sense of smell is incredible. So they can pick up on subtleties that are way beyond what we are aware of. And, you know, that's a big part of the book that we have as well. It starts off in Chapter 1 talking about body language, and because it's the foundation of everything we do with our dogs, and it makes dogs who they are. So, you know, I don't doubt that from the caller that what she was experiencing is totally accurate. Now, whether we call it ESP or just an incredible animal, you know, I don't know. I'll leave that up to you.
Although perhaps there we aren't reading things into what's going on. There was a New Yorker cartoon a few years ago in which a woman is being greeted by an excited dog at the front door. The balloon over her head contains a heart. The balloon over the dog's head is an open can of dog food.
Exactly right. That's very good.
We read love. The dog reads, oh, they're finally home. It's time to eat.
You know, when all is said and done, and this book, no book has ever been written like this before. I mean, there are lots of good dog training books out there. There are books that touch on behavior, but I'm proud to say I was involved. I've written books myself, proud to say I was involved with this one because it was written by the ultimate experts, those members of the American College of Veterinary Behaviorists. 360 pages, all based on science. But I will say, when all is said and done, the truth is, that I think our dogs understand us still better than we understand them.
And the book that Steve Dale is referring to is Decoding Your Dog from the American College of Veterinarian Behaviorists, co-edited by Dr. John Sarabasi, who is a guest on our show, and Steve Dale is one of the contributors. He also writes a twice-weekly syndicated newspaper column and has a couple of syndicated radio shows. We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be taking more of your calls and talking more about the things dogs can do and what they can't do and why and the whole hierarchical thing in a family and whatever we can get to. So stay with us. And we are back with Dr. John Sarabasi, veterinarian, co-editor of Decoding Your Dog from the American College of Veterinarian Behaviorists, and Steve Dale, one of the contributors to that book, also a newspaper columnist and a radio personality. And we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Steve, how much is a dog genetically coded to relate to humans in certain ways? Do they see the situation in pack terms, as we often hear?
Not sure I exactly understand what you're asking, but that is the brilliance of dogs as a species. When you think about it, dogs are awfully different than people, than great apes, than primates. They're not. And I don't believe there are two species on the planet that depend on one another in some ways. I mean, dogs trust us with their puppies. We trust our dogs with our baby infants. We can, and we do, offer them food, and they offer us a lot more than that. We sleep in the same beds now. I don't think that there are no two species that have that relationship as do dogs and people.
Although the dog often tries to take over the bed.
Yes. And we benefit in other ways that aren't often talked about. I mean, just petting a dog. There's data from all over the world, literally from Italian, Australian, American researchers, and others, that indicate that in of itself is a healthy thing. Certainly taking a dog for a walk. Dogs benefit by that. It's the most enriching thing you can do with your dog, according to one study, is actually taking your dog for a leash walk. And apparently that 411 that they sniff all along the walk, and you see that tail go back and forth, and they're thrilled, they associate it with the other end of the leash. Walking is a healthy thing for dogs to do. It's a healthy thing for us to do. It's healthy for the community. There are actually two studies about this as to how it's called social capital. When you take your dogs out for a walk, and a lot of people in the area do that. There are some communities where it seems there are people walking dogs everywhere. Those communities are safer. People tend to know one another. It is very different than communities with backyards where it seems no one walks their dogs.
Now, about dogs wagging their tails, I saw something in the newspaper the other day that suggested that, John, that when dogs wag their tails to the left, it means something different than when they wag their tails to the right. Is that possible?
Yes, it is, actually. But before I get to that, the other thing I want to kind of follow up real quickly on with Steve's comments were, you know, I heard something the other day, an analogy that I thought was really great. If we all can think of our dogs not as animals that we need to dominate or be in control of, but think of them as roommates in our household, I think maybe our attitudes towards our dogs would be a lot more conducive to the beneficial relationship that it is in many cases.
Well,
so,
Steve mentioned babies. Dogs sometimes appear to be jealous of a new baby in the family, and sometimes they become very protective of a newborn. I always thought that when they become jealous, it's because they sense that they've been moved down the pack hierarchy.
Yeah, I guess I don't agree with that. I mean, dogs are
that's why I'm not a vet.
Yeah, right. And that's why I'm not a radio host. So, dogs definitely are attention-demanding animals. So, if you want to call that jealousy, man, I guess you can do that. But the need to acquire attention and interaction is very strong. And, I think if that attention is being directed towards a child and the dog is working really hard to want to work it back towards their end of things, I can see them doing some things to try and get attention from the owners. But, is that jealousy? For me, jealousy is an intent to do harm or a wish to do harm or ill will. And I don't think by any means we see that in our dogs.
So getting back to the wagging of the tail to the right or to the left.
Yeah, there's actually a study, and I don't really have the specifics on it, but there is a study that shows that dogs can pick up the overall direction of the wag. So if it favors, for example, towards the right, and I think this is correct, it's directed towards the right, that's a positive interaction cue, whereas if it's to the left, it means something completely different. And the study just looked at the reaction of the receiving dog, not the dog that's wagging, but the dog that's receiving that, and the response was very consistent, a positive response on the part of the receiver with a tail wag that predominates to the right versus a negative response to the other direction. So, yeah, it's not so silly as it sounds.
Well, Steve, of course, cats only wag their tails when they're annoyed. So is that a reason that cats and dogs don't always get along?
Actually, for the most part, cats and dogs do get along. Increasingly, people in America, now it's up to about just over 30% of folks that have a dog have a cat. And vice versa. And we don't need Jimmy Carter to intercede in all these households. So something must be going right. And in general, they kind of do get along. And I would even go as far as saying, are you ready for this, that cats and dogs sometimes get along better than cats and cats or dogs and dogs. It's all about the individuals and the way they're introduced. That's what the real secret is.
And they all have different personalities. You can take two dogs from the same litter, and they are quite different. The same with cats.
Absolutely true, yes.
John from Paramus. Hi, you're on the air.
How you doing? Yeah, I have a cockapoo, a combination of cocker spaniel and poodle. I just wanted to know, what do you think about all this cross-breeding, especially with poodles?
Oh, well, I mean, I can answer that. First thing I want to do is give a shout-out to New Jersey. I'm a native of Jersey City, so it's good to hear all of these New Jersey callers coming in.
And you don't want to talk about Chris Christie and his problems?
Oh, wow. Do we want to get political?
I hear that his whole governorship is going to the dog, so I guess we could bring it in.
Hey, you know what? I know how to solve Chris Christie's problem or any public official's problem. Get a dog. Your reputation changes instantly.
Yeah. It's why the British love to have themselves painted by people like Van Dyke with their dogs.
That's right.
So, I mean, just to answer the caller's question, I mean, crossbreeding is, the more that an animal is crossbred, I think the stronger their DNA is, and they're much more... we see less specific disease problems and medical problems with crossbred animals than we do sometimes with purebred. So as we select for a specific breed, sometimes we also select for genes that make the animal more predisposed to certain medical conditions. So crossbreeding is not a problem at all. I mean, most of my clients in my general practice, most of my dogs are crossbred to some degree, and so that's fine. What the other aspect of that, though, is the marketing that some of these crossbred animals have to go through. Cockapoo's been around for a long time, and they're not a specific breed. They're a highly recognized crossbred. But there's a lot of these designer breeds that are out there now that are bringing in lots of a fairly high fee. And, I mean, they're crossbreds. That's not a slight against them, but they are crossbreds.
And most of them are with poodles, golden doodles, there's the lab poodle combos.
Mm-hmm.
The thinking behind that originally was that here is it's a marketing thing. Some people are allergic to dogs, so here is a dog that presumably is hypoallergenic. First thing is that there's no real truly hypoallergenic dog breed. It depends on the individual person, the individual dog. Secondly, my concern is where some of these so-called designer breeds come from. So dogs like Beagles, that's a beagle and a Basset Hound, I believe. But some of these crossbred dogs are from puppy mills. And those that are sold at pet stores, if it were me, I would walk quickly the other way. Do not purchase those dogs.
Lisa from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a question about dogs that mark or pee on trees and garbage cans and that kind of thing, and other dogs that smell that, and then they kind of get into a pissing contest, and I'm wondering what exactly the dogs are picking up on when they smell each other's pee.
Go for it, Steve.
Oh, okay. Sure. When it comes to dog pee, I try to know my stuff.
You're in good company.
We don't exactly know really what dogs are sniffing when they sniff that, but we know some things, and they can identify. It's like this. It's like if you left your business card on that fire hydrant or on that tree and it had a lot more information about you than you typically have on your business card. It would be like what is one of those online dating services that says everything about you? It's like a harmony.com for dogs, sort of, even if they're spayed or neutered. There's that information on there. And wouldn't it be fascinating if every time you walk by a tree, you can see that information? Now, whether dogs actually feel that I have to piss higher than the other dog, maybe John has a point of view on this. I don't honestly know. And what's interesting to me is some dogs seem to aim higher. So I personally, I don't know why.
Well, we have very little time, and I just did want to talk about smell in another way because dogs have such a great sense of smell. They're being used now to sniff out explosives and drugs and cancer. Now, what is it about that? Dogs have a much larger part of their brain devoted to smell?
There's that, and plus just all the nerve endings that are around the olfactory organs of the dog. I mean, they say that, you know, dogs can smell up to 100 times more than what people can smell. And an analogy that I read that I think is a really excellent one, and one that we can identify with, is that it would be as if we would be able to see, if we saw as well as dogs smell, we would be able to see up to 3,000 miles away and still see it clearly.
Wow.
So that kind of gives you an idea of just how acute a dog's sense of smell is. Another analogy is, you know, if you put a teaspoon of sugar in 1 million gallons of water, dogs can still pick that up. So it's unbelievable.
We've run out of time, so we can't get to what you should feed them. Human food? Quickly.
Oh, a little bit is not particularly harmful. No chocolate. I mean, there are certain things you should never feed a dog.
Okay. Well, anyway, Steve, Dale, John, Dr. John Sarabasi, thank you so much for talking with us on today's Please Explain. We've run out of time.
Oh, no.
Okay. Thanks, Leonard.